Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar of 2021, February 19. This is an attempt to engage our astronomers during the stay-home situation with the enduring ongoing lockdown throughout the New York Skies territory. The lesson today is Features of Star Atlases, and this is the inaugural edition of the audio-digital version of the seminar. It's an experiment, so when you make your comments, I really do want to see if there are any glitches or improvements or accolades or condemnations or whatever, besides questions and comments on the content. You need two files for this lesson. If you did not, you have the audio file you're listening to now, and you also need the video file which has the slides or the pictures. If you missed it, go to www.nyskies.org, and among the punch words at the top of the screen underneath the title is AV files, audio video files. Punch that and you get a little description of how the seminar will work, and under the blah blah on that page is the list of the seminar sessions on file. Of course you have only the single one because this is the first of hopefully an ongoing series until the lockdowns are over. If we in the preamble there and also in summary form in this video file show you how you can get to our email group and post comments or questions to it. So if we scroll down to slide number one, and the slides are numbered in the upper left corner, we see a view of Orion in the east as it is rising. I hope that you are generally familiar with the constellations, and if you're interested in star atlases, you probably already do sky watching and have some star identification skills. But there is Orion in the east. You have the horizon and compass points at the bottom. And the belt of Orion, the three stars close together, vertically in the center, and surrounding it, tilted to the left, is a quadrilateral of four stars. The downtown section of Orion consists of the four enclosing stars with the belt in the middle. There are no labels on this particular chart for the star names, but just to orient yourself, roughly anyway, to the left of the belt, about a third of the way toward the left margin, is Betelgeuse. And to the right of the belt, again about maybe a quarter of the way to the right margin, is Rigel. And that's one diagonal of that quadrilateral. So if you draw the other diagonal to complement it, you get the quadrilateral. By the way, I call that quadrilateral the strike zone. If you play baseball, you know, baseball, the pitcher has to get the ball over the home plate between the batter's shoulders and his knees. And the classical configuration of Orion, the upper left side of that quadrilateral, including Betelgeuse, are the shoulders, and the lower right side with Rigel are the knees. And if the belt represents home plate, then that is where a valid strike ball has to be thrown. So that's just a way to describe it. Other stars in the field, down near the bottom, just rising, is Sirius. And up at the top center, almost off the sheet, is Aldebaran. Over to the toward the lower left, two vertical bright stars, the upper being Castor and the lower being Pollux. So that kind of lays out that area of the sky. Now this is a scene in landscape mode, because usually, although not always, but usually it's a wide field eyesight view as you went outside and looked in the sky, and often there actually is a landscape, not, instead of just a line, some landscape. Planetarium program put trees and houses and stuff, so it's a landscape view. It does not necessarily mean the rectangular frame of the picture is horizontal. That's the meaning in computer printing. And then porch would be if the long dimension is vertical. It simply is the scene outside which takes into account the day, the hour, and the latitude. This, for instance, is the view of Orion in the nightfall hours in autumn at the beginning of the annual globe at night sessions in New York skies. New York skies stays with just Orion, the Hunter, as the target constellation. I know other groups try to, well, globe at night runs all year round using different constellations with the season, and of course it has constellations for the southern hemisphere observers also. But we found that trying to get the public to recognize any constellation other than the Big Dipper and Orion just went down in flames. So we just take Orion when it comes into view during the evening hours in fall, and we follow that all the way until the twilight hours in April. But the important thing is that a half hour from now or a half hour earlier, Orion was displaced relative to the horizon. And if you go out a week earlier or a week late, you also get a displacement. So this cannot, and of course if you go to a different latitude, a radically different latitude, you're going to get a different tilt and height of the constellation. So this cannot be a reference map. It's a good map if, let's say, there was a configuration of planets. The line that runs lower left to top center is the ecliptic, the way along which the planets and the moon course. So this could be for some date and hour where some planets are near Castor Pollux and you want to show, you know, where they are over your skyline. It could also be for a range of dates because a very bright comet is flowing through this, and then you have tick marks along the path for the specific dates. But in general, a map like this has to have in context, or maybe in a title on the sheet, the date, the hour, and the location. It can be, the location can be a town or county. And the last. Okay, so we now move to slide number two. And slide number two, again, is a landscape view that shows Orion when it is setting. Again, the horizon at the bottom, you have the compass points, and the ecliptic, now from top center to lower right, is on the right side of the constellation. Now, if you flip between slides 1 and 2, you'll notice that around Orion are celestial directions. In this scene here, slide 2, north is to the upper right of Orion, west is to the lower right, and south is to the lower left, and east is to the upper left. On the sky, if you do sky watching, observing, whatever, west is always the easy direction to tell because that's the direction that the stars move into or toward due to the diurnal rotation of the Earth. If you see Orion at a certain hour, you go out an hour later, it drifted across the sky, and the direction of that drift is west. North on the sky is toward the North Celestial Pole, for the Northern Hemisphere anyway. North Celestial Pole, which in our era, we are very blessed to have it marked by a reasonably bright star, the North Star or Polaris. And the other two directions, south and east, are sort of locked in around the compass. But you see that Orion's orientation changed. It is no longer Sirius below, Sirius is off to the left, and Aldebaran is off to the right rather than above. This happens to be Orion, let's say, in the evening hours of April, toward the end of our annual Globet night, because thereafter Orion sets into twilight, and you cannot get good readings of the transparency. Okay, we move on to slide number 3, and in this scene is a portrait view, the way you would have, say, a map of your town or a map of your state. The north is at the top, and then don't forget we're looking up into the celestial sphere, so you have west at the right and east at the left, and then south at the bottom. So maps in an atlas are oriented this way. Now I know when I went to New Zealand I did see a few atlases locally produced for the southern hemisphere where south is up, that is this whole scene is turned over 180 degrees. But for almost every atlas that you would reasonably buy up here in the northern latitudes in the United States, north would be at the top on all of its sheets. This then is a cardinal point to bear in mind. Later on we'll see a slide where the direction will be a little easier to keep track of because you have the celestial grid of latitude and longitude, which means right ascension and declination on the maps. For the moment we just have the concept of a portrait view as opposed to a landscape view. This therefore does not have any dependency for date, hour, or latitude. Okay, this is slide 4, and here has no markings in it at all because I wanted to bring out a couple of interesting points about atlases. Stars in the sky are points, points. And they have different luminosities, they send more or less light to us, but on a printed map and even in a digital map with illuminated pixels, you can't get the wide range or ratio of brightnesses that you do from the illumination from the stars. So conventionally for printed atlases, the brightnesses are indicated by the size of the dot. So on this particular sheet, again with Orion, Rigel is probably, that's the largest dot on this particular sheet, indicating that it's the brightest of the stars here. And then the second brightest, Aldebaran, Procyon, or Procyon, and Betelgeuse are next in brightness, and the others scale down to the smallest dots, which represent the dimmest stars in this particular field. The older star atlases, particularly ones which have an artistic quality besides the utilitarian value, the stars are drawn like very fancy or less fancy according to the brightness snowflakes, having more spikes, more points for the brightest stars, and the dimmest and simplest ones might be like tiny asterisks. That's one. The other is I have here white stars on a dark, in this case blue, because I like blue, background. It kind of looks like the sky too. Background. Whereas most star atlases will have black stars, sometimes colored stars for the spectral types, black stars on a white background. Now that star atlas, if you took it outside and used it under the stars at night, and you try to read it with a light, even a red one, to keep your night vision, you will get dazzled and confused with all that white surface reflecting the light back up at you. So many atlases, the publishers, issue two versions, a desk version, which is the black on white background for use indoors, and then a field edition, which is white stars on a dark background like the scene we see here. And not only is that a lot easier on your eyes because you have a darker background which does not reflect all that much light. Actually, if by any chance your atlas has a blue background like the scene here, and you shine your red safety light on it to read it, no light is reflected back because only blue is reflected and no blue is being sent onto the sheet, so the background looks black. Very interesting little tip. The field edition also tends to be printed on a smaller size of paper. Your desktop assumes you have an infinitely large surface, like a conference room table or a lunch table or something, and you can spread it all out. Field edition has to fit into your observing kit, and while you can roll it gently, you certainly don't want to have to fold it. It's also printed on a more sacrificial type of paper, so if you do spoil one, it's not all that terrible. You can generally get another copy, but the desk edition with a nice binder in it and usually has some text material associated with it, has a gazetteer of objects and so on. You don't want to get that messed up under nighttime conditions. But that's a point to mind when you're looking for an atlas. Does it also have a field edition, if that's what you really need? All right, we move on to slide number 5. And from now on, we're going to look at many features of star atlases one by one. Of course, on a real atlas chart, and there'll be a set of these at the end of the lesson, has many features all at once on the same sheet. But to give you focus on what to look for, I have the features put up singly. Here we have proper names. Many of the brighter stars will be labeled on your atlas with the proper names. The stars here, the quadrilateral, the strike zone figure of Orion, starting with Betelgeuse on the upper left, going clockwise, we have Bellatrix, Rigel, and Safe. And then the three stars for the belt, they have their names. And you got Aldebaran labeled up there at the top center, and Procyon off on the near the left margin among the stars. I think it's one. Okay, Gamaliel is labeled also. Okay, so those stars, the author chooses which ones to actually label. He may say label all the stars to a certain limiting magnitude, like say 1.5 magnitude, or he may simply label the ones where he thinks are important to anchor the rest of the constellation onto. About 1,000 stars have labels or proper names, but if you put them on your chart, you'll have a big mishmash, somewhat like a street map with all the street names. They'll start to overlap, or they have to be drawn in sideways, and so on. And if you put points of interest on it also. So you try to have a balance between how much stuff to put into the map versus how useful the map becomes. So this is probably the maximum number in this particular part of the sky for proper names that you'd want to have on an atlas. Also notice that in a crowded field, like in the belt area, the labels might overlap or interfere. So on a printed atlas, the author will simply write the label a little off to one side or the other, to avoid interference, and you also have to worry about covering a desired feature on the atlas. So it's a little tricky composing these atlases. It's not all that trivial. Alright, here we have slide number 6, and in this slide here we are looking at catch figures or stick figures. The author draws lines connecting the stars kind of how he wants them, or maybe following the model of some other star chart. And there's a whole cult between one style of drawing the catch figures and another. I would just go with whatever ones are on the map. I myself don't like the stick figures, simply because the lines often join stars that you can't see from bright sky or gray sky environment. Like, for instance, they show the club stars of Orion, where he's holding the club up in his hand off of Betelgeuse, and those stars you can't see from the major town anyway. And then you have the arm going off to the right to show the shield or the skin that he's holding, and it joins all the stars in that area. You probably only see two in your night sky, so the cash figure is then dissolved and ruined. But the author typically will have, in most star atlases, even the deeper ones for telescopic use, they'll throw in the stick figures. And if your atlas does not have stick figures, consider drawing in the ones you like with a ruler and pencil. You'll take your time, draw the lines in lightly, and once you get the arrangement that you like, you can go over that a little more heavily. But always use pencil, because 3 years from now you find that you don't like those figures and you want to erase them. Okay, here we are on slide 7. And in this scene we have marked the star designations, both the Greek letter designations from Bayer in the early 1600s, and the Flamsteed numbers from the early 1700s. Both of these systems are independent, which is why you see many stars with both, and they are assigned constellation by constellation. And between the two, they cover most of the naked eye stars in the sky, so they are the most commonly used designations among home astronomers. The Bayer numbers start at the western edge of the constellation and progress along a scrimmage line to the eastern side where the high numbers are. The Greek letters go zigzag all over the place because they tend to be assigned in order of brightness. Not strictly so, but that's the tendency. The earlier letters being for the brighter stars, and the later letters going to the dimmer ones. If you look at Taurus, look at Lepus, look at Eridanus, look at the constellation in the margins of the frame, you'll see many of the Greek letters and numbers are duplicated within Orion. So that is a very handy feature to have. Bear in mind that when Bayer and Flamsteed flourished, formal or official boundaries between the constellations were not established. And in fact, in both catalogs, Bayer and Flamsteed sometimes designated the same individual star as being in adjacent constellations. So Gamma Aurigae, as one example, was also cataloged as Beta in Taurus, and Alpha Andromedae was also the Delta star in Pegasus. So that happens to be a peculiarity, and later on one of the next slides will show how that was resolved. Okay, slide 8 shows the constellation boundaries, the formal demarcations between the constellations. These were established in the 1920s by the International Astronomical Union as one of its earliest official acts. The IAU in its present form fired up in 1922, and they set up a commission to get all these things straightened out. They also chucked out a lot of vanity constellations or minority constellations. There were about 120 altogether at that time, and kept 88. They kept all of the classical constellations and a selection of the more modern ones from the Renaissance and forward. So then they drew the boundaries. They're rectilinear, north, south, east, west. They follow the hour circles and declination parallels. In this scene here, because Orion is near the equator, they look like rectilinear, like graph paper, or lines drawn along the axes of graph paper. But if you look up in the northern parts of the sky, you know, Auriga or Lyra, Hercules, Draco, well, that's an extreme example of Cygnus. You find that the parallels of declination are arcs concentric with each other, and the hour circles arc toward the north celestial pole. Just the same thing. You look at a map of the United States. The latitude lines are arcs concentric with the north pole, a terrestrial pole, and then the longitude zones are curving into Canada to converge on that same pole. But you do need, on any but the very simplest atlases, maybe for bare eye view, a demarcation of the official boundaries. Okay, slide 9 shows the grid for the right ascensions and declinations. And on all atlases, it's a coarse grid, like the one we see here, typically 10 degrees by 10 degrees for declination, north-south, and east-west is hour by hour of right ascension. But you really don't want a very coarse grid printed on the map, because then it's like, or you'd be looking at the map through, say, window screen. So what you really, it's a framework, so to find stars with. If you need a reading of a point on the map, or you want to plot a point like the position of an asteroid, the earliest star atlases before computers would have a acetate transparent overlay with a finer grid printed on it. That you lay on top of the map and you register it marks in the corners of the frame, and you can read your positions through it. But you always have, even except for the very, very simplest of atlases, you do get a coordinate grid like this, and it comes in really, really handy. So that is something. Again, you can look at the north latitude constellation, north declination constellation, and you see how the declination parallels contract on the pole, and the hour circles aim into the pole. Slide 10 gives other coordinates that are drawn on atlases, but not the complete grid. They'll draw the ecliptic, which here runs upper left across to the upper right. And here we also have the galactic equator, lower left to like top center. I displaced Orion deliberately downward, so the belt of Orion is near the bottom of the chart, because just to bring the ecliptic into view. That's why Aldebaran is more centered in the map. The galactic equator is dimensioned in degrees, starting from its own zero point, which is the direction toward the galactic center. That's down in the constellation Scorpius and Sagittarius, and wraps around the sky heading northward through Aquila, Cygnus, Cassiopeia, Auriga, and then coming down into here. By the time you get to this reach in the Orion area, your longitudes along the galactic equator are in the 180s into the 200s degrees. The ecliptic can be dimensioned two ways, and some atlases will give you one or the other, and a few will give you both. You can dimension in degrees from the vernal equinox heading eastward. So by the time you get to Aldebaran, you're around 60 degrees of ecliptic longitude. And by the time you get to Gemini, a little bit to the right of the galactic equator, you're around 90 degrees. The other dimension is date, calendar date. The position of the sun in the ecliptic as it goes through its course in the year corresponds to the calendar date. So mid to late May would have the dates in the Aldebaran area, and then mid to late June would be where the galactic equator is, and a little bit to the almost to the end of the chart on the left. So that would give you a clue when or if the scene shown here is in fact visible. So here it is, a very merry day in May, and you got this thing you want to look at Orion because you read some news article about the Horsehead Nebula. So you pull out your chart for Orion, fixing to go out that night and look for it, but then you look at the dates along the ecliptic and you see that May and June are in this field, and if the sun is there, this whole area is in daylight, and you're not going to see Orion. But the ecliptic also, the degree division in longitude is how you can spot the planets. It ignores the displacement of the planets north and south. See, but the planet is so bright that if I say Jupiter on a certain day, a certain month, is at 80 degrees of longitude, well, I can spot 80 degrees of longitude on my atlas, and I look in that direction, well, the hell, the brightest thing in that area, a couple of degrees north and south, that is Jupiter. So that you do not get the entire grid. You don't have zones of latitude of galactic or zones of latitude of ecliptic. You do get the poles of the two grids. The north ecliptic pole is in Draco, and the north galactic pole is in Coma Berenices. Slide 11 shows another way, sometimes concurrent with the galactic equator, for showing where the Milky Way is. That's a colored or tinted band printed on the map. And it's up to you whether you like it or not. I happen not to like it so much because I find it a big distraction, but other people love it. In any case, the author uses some reference. They may use photometric data to draw the contours, or maybe star density counts in that area and draw contours or outlines. Or maybe just look at a lot of photographs of the Milky Way and eyeball the contour and then code it up so that it plots, you know, on the chart. And that's how you got the galactic equator. It's not shown on this one here, but you get the Milky Way contour, maybe with the equator drawn in. And you can take it or leave it. By the way, the color, and I started to say, the color is pretty much whatever the author wants. So blue is a common one, but you can get gray, sometimes, green. I've seen green on many atlases. But in any case, that is how you get the Milky Way. So it's something to look for when you choose a star atlas. Okay, next is slide 12. Where we see other features that you can put onto a star atlas, in this case, double stars. The double stars are almost always, I haven't seen any other really strong symbolism, always denoted by a spike extending through the star. So the stars could look like Saturn with the ring's edge on. Now on a printed star map, the author makes sure that there's a bit of spike on each side of the star, however big the star dot is. But sometimes, like in the way I made this picture for you, the star dot printed bigger or than the dot itself, and that's because of the limitation of the program I use to construct these pictures. But if you see a star with a horizontal bar through it, that denotes a double star. The author took his data from some particular star catalog, and he may have even made a selection of that, depending, for instance, on the limiting magnitude of his star atlas. So if his star atlas plots stars to eighth magnitude, then reasonably, if a double star has a 10th or 12th magnitude companion, he may just leave it out. Or he will only put in selected dimmer ones. But the selection is there, and you still have to go to a catalog of double stars to get the specifications for it. You go by the star label, which might be a Flamsteed or Beyer designation, or it may be a catalog number in some double star roster. Okay, slide 13 shows variable stars, stars that change their brilliance over time, either rhythmically or not, periods of a few days to many, many months. Again, no specification are given on the map of the variation pattern or profile, but just that, yep, that is a variable star, and you then have to refer to an atlas to find it. And then, I'm not out of a catalog to find it and then read up about it. There are two common ways to show a variable star. One, which is in this scene here, which I myself don't like, is to show an open circle for the star, and the size of the dot, the size of the circle is the maximum brilliance of the star. The other method is to show the circle for the bright part of the star cycle and a smaller dot within it to show the star at minimum brilliance. If the minimum brilliance is below the magnitude limit of the chart, then it's left out. And if you see just the open circle, you can surmise, okay, the star at dimmest is beyond the chart limit. It can be a little confusing if you're just flipping through the sheet looking for a certain constellation. Like, for instance, I'm looking here at Orion, and at first glance, I ask, well, where the hell is Betelgeuse? Betelgeuse! And they say, okay, it's the open circle over there. See, so again, you will have to decide for yourself whether the author's method of showing variable stars conflicts with some other interest you have for getting that particular star atlas. Slide 14 shows what most of us want in the star atlas. Where the hell are the deep sky objects? Well, in this particular scene, I happen to put up those which could reasonably be seen in binoculars. All of these can be seen from New York City. Some require a little bit skill, and you may want to have a map of somewhat fainter stars to box in the object, but all of these are in fact city objects. Nebulae, clusters, and galaxies, and the symbols used for each category actually hark back to the 1950s, when the first major telescopic or small scopes, that's what we had back then, small scopes, atlas came out. The Scalnate Plaso, or Atlas Coeli Atlas, and that one had stars down to eighth magnitude. And it was a bonanza for us who had just acquired the new telescopes or were going into mirror making right after World War II, and you had, you know, a 100 millimeter reflector, 150 millimeter reflector. Any case, deep sky objects, the symbols from the Scalnate Plaso are almost the same ones used today. No one could really come up with a better or otherwise more mnemonic symbolism. So the dotted circles still are open clusters. The crosshair circle is a globular cluster. Squares, or for larger nebulae, the actual contour outline is for nebulae, open nebulae, and the globular nebulae, the remains of novas and stuff, are a double ring circle, and then galaxies are little ellipses. And the labels are the almost always the NGC catalog number, but for the more prominent ones, they'll include also the Messier number, the M number. There's a little problem when you have many objects put together, like in the Sword of Orion or in Monoceros, about halfway between Betelgeuse and Procyon, the objects of the clusters of the nebulae kind of overlap. One little point to bear in mind is that for a given star atlas, the fact that they plot a feature on it doesn't necessarily mean that it is within the range of the instrument that the atlas is intended for, because very often, if you have a star atlas with ninth magnitude stars, the author will very commonly plot deep sky objects much fainter, 11th, 12th, 13th magnitude. And it's up to you whether you want to fight and get those objects in a scope using that particular atlas. So that's a consideration for choosing a star atlas. A little thing, by the way, the cluster of the group of clusters in Manasseh, as I pointed out before, the Rosette cluster, can be seen from New York with the bare eye on a nice dark winter night, and you almost always will see the Orion Nebula in the Sword as long as the transparency is 3.5 magnitude or better, which is easily obtained from the city. Slide 15 shows the effect of limiting magnitude, how faint stars are plotted on the atlas. And this is really a determination based on how you're going to use the atlas. This is probably the deepest level of stars that you would want on an atlas that's intended for binocular use. As a general rule, if you're plotting the path, you're looking up an asteroid or a comet, and from the literature about it, you have an anticipated magnitude, let's say 6.5 magnitude for a comet, then you really should use a atlas chart, or a whole atlas, which shows stars at least one magnitude dimmer. That way, when you see the comet, you have enough contextual stars around it, which you can find on your atlas, to confirm that, yes, that thing there is the comet, not a nebula, which you just never happen to look at. And seeing dimmer stars than that plotted on the atlas will help you to again confirm the identity. Now, I've been speaking of catalogs on and off in the last several slides. The book form of a atlas will often include gazetteer of the features plotted on the atlas. They're typically each plate will have an adjoining or an accompanying table of those objects. And many atlases, especially those which are a boxed set of single sheets, you buy a separate book. Like the Scale Peso catalog was a bound book with tables and tables and tables and tables of the stuff in the atlas, and then you had the boxed set of the charts themselves. So depending on how you're going to use the atlas, you may want the book form of an atlas which has the gazetteer sheet by sheet, or a separate catalog which you can refer to as you need to. But that's an idea of limiting magnitude for a star atlas. Slide number 16, slide 16, shows the effect of scale in star atlases. On a printed map, the scale is the number of millimeters per degree on the sky. You don't have the linear measure like you do on the Earth. So on an Earth map of your town, and in the title block in one corner, it shows scale 1 to 10,000, which means that a centimeter on the map corresponds to a 100 meters on the ground. But on the sky, you don't have that convenience of linear measure, so we have to use degrees. And the more millimeters per degree, that is, the larger dimension on the map covering one degree, the more detail that can be put onto the map, such as fainter stars or additional deep sky objects, and perhaps labels on the dimmer star beyond the range of the Beyer-Flamsteed stars, you can insert. So as an example, if I have a star atlas 10 millimeters to the degree, and the belt stars in Orion span 3 degrees, then on the map the belt spans 30 degrees. As an example of how you can put a deep sky object in the map, over about halfway between the belt and the left margin is an arc, a contour, like a scarf or a long Christmas stocking or a snake that just had too much for lunch. That is the Bernard Loop. You're not going to see the Bernard Loop in any ordinary telescope. That's a photographic subject. In fact, that's how it was discovered. But you can have it there. Of course, if you want to photograph it, now you know where it is. See, but don't get too worked up that a star atlas has the Brazilian number of deep sky objects, of which your 80 millimeter reflector will show perhaps 2,000 of them. Okay, here we have slide 17, which shows an uncommon but could be helpful, especially if you're in an educational setting or you just like astrophysics or dynamics of the stars in the sky, proper motion, the real space motion of the stars as they swirl around in our galaxy. And here the author has darts sticking out from the stars for the direction and distance that the star traveled in 10,000 years. Now Procyon over there near the left side has a long dart because in 10,000 years that's how far it moves, several degrees. It's a nearby star and it also has a high space movement, kilometers per second, relative to the Sun. And same with some stars in the lower right in Eridanus. They are actually nearby. Actually, the one with the longest dart is Epsilon Eridani, which is a nearby star. If you look up at the upper right, where Aldebaran and the Hyades, you'll see that the darts for the stars in the Hyades are about the same length and in the same direction, because the stars in the Hyades are a gravity-binded unit moving through space as a flock, congregation. That's how we often come onto a cluster which we think is one, so you plot the proper motions. And those would have common proper motion belong to the cluster, whereas fierce stars will have deviant or divergent proper motions. We actually got one in the Hyades. Look, the proper motion for Aldebaran goes off in another direction. It is not a actual member of the Hyades cluster. If you look at the Orion, downtown Orion, the darts are very small, showing that it has very small proper motion, so that configuration of stars endured for a long time, certainly for 10,000 years. There's almost no motion. In fact, anthropologists used this feature because by 10,000 years ago, you can extend the proper motion in reverse time, not just forward. What happens was that 10,000 years ago, human beings were starting to be aware of the sky, that they were developing calendars, building monuments for alignments with the rising settings, assigning names to the constellations and tracking the planets. And in their writings or pictograms or whatever, symbolisms, they describe, among other things, what we now know as Orion. And we try to say, well, is that really our Orion? Because proper motions would distort the constellations. Well, it turns out that by good luck, not only is Orion a very prominent, unmistakable gathering of stars, it endured over the entirety of basic, you know, recorded history. So when we read in some ancient writing about Orion, we're pretty confident that's what we're looking at. And so when you see Orion in the sky, you're seeing the same set of stars that were seen, you know, 8,000, 9,000, before the pyramids were built, you know, when the Tower of Jericho was built. Okay, now on slide 18, we have another feature which is not often shown on star atlas. Certainly no modern star atlas shows this. But what you may come across is a star atlas that has the previous features we looked at, and then a plastic overlay, which is probably bound in with the book. So if you lay that over the starry chart, it has on it the constellation allegorical or the mythical creatures. So here we see Orion, the way it's conventionally drawn. Here he has the strong hero type stance. One arm he's holding the skin or the cloth to distract the bull, and in his other arm off of Betelgeuse, he has a 2x4 or maybe it's a hunk of wood or a branch for beating him. And then over on the left we see Monoceros, and it does look like he's getting set to peg Orion with that horn. We see Eridanus running off as a river on the lower right. Upper right you have Taurus with the head around the Hyades, and the body off to the, going off the right. Now Deuteron is a red tinted star. It's easier to see if you use binoculars, and it does sit in the bull's eye, actually the right eye. And from then on, once that was recognized, from then on all targets such as in archery or in gunning, rifling, the target bullseye is red, and it's red because the original bullseye in the sky with Aldebaran is red. Now I'm confident that one of you guys will write to me in the e-group, "Oh, but John, you know, I belong to this gun club, and the targets there use blue bullseyes." My response is pretty simple: go find another gun club. There's one feature of star atlases I would love to see, but none of them actually do so, and that is the new category of target for home astronomers, and especially ones which would be shown to the general public. And they are the planetary stars, stars which host their own planetary systems with exoplanets or extrasolar planets. There are about 110 as of early 2021, 110 bare eye stars in both hemispheres of the celestial sphere which host planets. And many of them are obvious stars in the sky, like Pollux in Gemini is a planetary star. Aldebaran is a planetary star, and many others around the sky. Alpha Centauri is a planetary star also for the southern hemisphere folk. There's no symbolism that I ever came across which kind of denotes a planetary star, and the text material with a star atlas or even in the catalog usually just show like the first five or six that were discovered that were, you know, bright enough to see in the sky, and then that's it. So if you want to know what planetary stars are good to look at, you still have to go to the New York Sky's website, and probably the easiest way is just do a web search, Pasmino, my name, Papa Alpha Zulu, Mike India, November Oscar, plus extrasolar planet, or plus exoplanet, and one of the hits should be, "Are these stars looking back at us?" It's the title of the page, which you go click on, and you get the page, which has all the scuttlebutt about the 110 or so planetary stars, but they, you won't find them on star atlases. All right, the next one, slide 19 and on, are samples of sheets from common popular star atlases. And on them are most of the features that we discussed before, so you can intercompare them one among each other. The name of the atlas is in the lower left corner, which I digitally added. I did not take a Sharpie and louse up a good star atlas. That was digitally added in. So the first one is for the Bright Star Atlas, and there you see the Milky Way in the upper left corner of that chart, and at least on my computer screen it's green. But you can see the names of stars, the Bayer letters and the Flamsteed numbers, constellation boundaries, deep sky objects, the coordinate grid, and things like that. So by comparing them among each other, you get an idea of what is good, what is bad, what to look for, what satisfies you, what you wish was added in, and all of that. All of these are currently, as of 2021, at sale, or in some cases the larger libraries that you can borrow them out and assess them. The last of the set of six here is a special favorite for me. It comes from the Sky and Telescope Bright Pocket Sky Atlas. It has the same scale as most of the others, but instead of being a large book form, it's actually pocket. You need a big pocket, you need a great coat to carry it. But it's about roughly half letter size or half A4 size charts. And to make up for the small physical size of each, given the scale, the atlas has like 150 sheets, so it's a thickish book. The reason I like this as my favorite, I'll give you a clue, but you got to work it out yourself. There is, in the upper center, among the text, a feature plotted here, which is pretty emotional and sensitive, and I like it. So if you can find it, post a note in the e-group about it. If you did not find it, we're fully on you. But there are the six charts, samples that you can play with and intercompare with them and match them up with the one by one feature, most of the blue background slides, 1 through 18. I have a pop question for you, actually two of them. If you go back to slide 10, which shows the ecliptic and the galactic equator, you have there the Hyades and the Pleiades star cluster, now one on each side of the ecliptic. If I were to tell you about the Beehive cluster is in Cancer, it's not on the chart, off the chart. The coat hanger is in Vorpecula. The Rosette is in Monoceros, although it's not on this particular chart. But the Hyades are in Taurus, and the Pleiades are in Taurus. So the question is, why are the Hyades and Pleiades plural, whereas essentially every other deep sky object is singular? The next question is a little complicated, and you kind of better be a lunar observer for this. You've seen or maybe heard about occultations by the moon of stars in the Hyades and also in the Pleiades. We had a round of Hyades occultation in 2019 and 2020, but none of the Pleiades. Around 2010 and so, we had a round of occultation in the Pleiades, but not the Hyades. Why do we have occultation in the one for a while, and then in the other for a while, many years, and then there are years in between where they miss altogether, we have none. But we can never get Hyades and Pleiades mixed together. So that's your pop question number two. Alright, that's it for the Features in Star Atlases for the seminar of February 19th, 2021. If this method of doing the seminar works out and we continue them, stand by for the next installment. Until then, be sure to post your comments or questions in the e-group. That's in NYSKIES at groups.io. Until then, pray for clear skies.